Radio.
Guinness and God presents Professor Anne Hunt, speaking on the topic, Holiness and Sainthood. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan Team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
God and the God who makes these wonderful things happen. And I must say it's a pleasure to be with you. It's been amazing these last few weeks. I've had a number of calls to my office about Mary McKillop. Is she the great advocate of Australian feminism, for example? What about miracles? Has she been made a saint because she's worked miracles? And I said, no. She's not made a saint because she's worked miracles. Miracles are just part of the process of verification. But certainly what's clear to me, and which I think is actually really exciting, is that Australia is in the grip of canonisation fever right now. We've never had so many calls. We actually don't have enough people in our faculty to meet the need. Every radio station wants somebody to be speaking about the canonisation and what it means and all the things that go with that. And actually it's worth remembering, it's actually over the cult of the saints that was one of the major prompts for the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther, John Calvin, very serious criticisms of the church, and that had a lot to do with the cult of the saints, a lot to do about, well, can you actually pray to dead people? Can you pray for dead people? And this was related to the cult of the relics. And also the whole phenomenon of indulgences. And it is true, Martin Luther had some very well-justified criticisms of the church at that time and abuse of its power. Indulgences at the time were being used certainly by some church authorities to help fund some of the crusades. And this was a way of raising money. And of to some extent, preying on people's insecurities. Should they be buying indulgences for their relatives who have died, who perhaps not made their way to heaven yet? And it was preying upon their fears and their concerns. And so the question theologically was, can you pray for the dead? Can you pray to the dead? What is the place of saints? Do I need to go through saints to get to God? And of course the great cry of the reformers was, well, sola Christi, only Christ, sola scriptura, scriptures alone. Grace was not something that you could buy or sell. And it's as true now as it is then. We don't buy or sell grace. We do pray for the dead. But the saints don't actually lie. We don't have to go through the saints to go to God. And in fact, that's what I'd like to talk about today, is how they fit in. Where do they actually stand in our lives and for us? And I do have to confess that the saints mean a lot to me. In fact, I consider that my first research project that I can remember in my whole life was actually around the time of my confirmation. I haven't told many people this story. But I was in about grade 5 at the time, and we were about to make our confirmation. We were to choose the saints whose name we would take. And I remember investing a lot of time, a lot of energy in this project, and I loved learning about the saints. And after much reading and much careful reflection, I decided who I wanted to have as my patron saint, the saint whose name I would take as my confirmation name. I'm going to tell you her name in a minute. I had a number of reasons for choosing her. One of them is that I reasoned, remember my first degree was in mathematics and chemistry. I love numbers and I love mathematics. And part of my thinking was that not many people would choose this particular saint, and therefore she'd have more time for me. I thought that was a really good argument. I wasn't going to pick somebody like Bernadette of Lourdes or somebody that a whole lot of people would pick. If I picked somebody who was fairly unusual, she'd have more time for me. And I remember the evening I took the form that had to be filled out that they'd given us at school, and I took it to my father, who was a fairly quiet and reserved man, a teacher, and he was sitting at his desk. So I just came up to him sideways. I recall he didn't actually look at me. He was a piece of paper, and I just slipped it under his nose and said, and he started to fill it out, filled in my name and his name and everything else. And then he said, "What name have you chosen?" And I told him the name, and actually, it's the only time I've ever seen my father do almost the equivalent of levitation. He went up about 3 inches into the air, about 10 centimetres, and came down. And he said, "You're not having that." And I was a bit in shock then. I'm not exactly sure what happened next. The name that I had chosen was Skyscraper. Yeah. And he thought, you could see the shock on his face. There was no way that I was going to have Scholastica. I can't remember exactly what happened next. Because remember, I put a lot of time into this. And I don't remember whether he asked me who my second choice was, or whether he just decided what I was going to have. Anyway, I ended up with Thérèse of Lisieux, the little flower. And he actually had great devotion to her. And years later, just a few years ago, when he was an elderly man and approaching death himself, I was reminded of his great devotion to Thérèse of Lisieux. And actually, in his missal, after he'd died, I found a little prayer card for her. And it meant a lot to me because of this story. Anyway, I ended up with Thérèse of Lisieux. But I delighted in telling him in one of our last conversations together that I was still Scholastica's girl. And even now, every year, I remember the Feast of Saint Scholastica. And even though I wasn't allowed to have her as my name, she was my person. What my father didn't know is that, he just thought it had sounded utterly pretentious, and perhaps he was right, but I hadn't chosen it that way. Scholastica was actually the sister of St. Benedict, the great founder of Benedictine monasticism, an extraordinary figure in the history of the church. And that was actually his confirmation name. And what he didn't realize, that part of my choosing it was part of my devotion to him, that I was choosing the sister, Scholastica, of Benedict. But anyway, I didn't get it, but it was all right. Scholastica and I still like that. I think it's true, isn't it, that the notion of saints, and that's what I've seen in the last few weeks with various people from the media calling the university to ask questions about saints and miracles and what's this all about and what does it really mean. That whole notion of saints and of holiness, I think, intrigues us and fascinates us. Whether one comes from the perspective of real scepticism, and some of the things that you're seeing in the press now and on some of the blog sites express a very real scepticism, or whether one comes from a perspective of awe at these people who do such amazing things. And even John Henry Newman, who was beatified, so he's now officially called Blessed. He was a cardinal, Cardinal John Henry Newman, now Blessed John Henry Newman. Even he wrote, and I quote, "A saint is a peculiar being." I find that an interesting quote. He's an interesting man in his own right, and I was lucky just a few weeks ago to be in England at the time of his beatification. And I went to Birmingham where the ceremony took place. And the Pope was there. Enormous reaction against the Pope's visit to England. Not by everyone, but by a very vocal minority. There were some protests in the streets and so on and so forth. It was actually a beautiful ceremony in an open air park just outside of Birmingham where he had died. And I've spent a lot of, and he was 89 when he died. A great man, died in 1890. So 120 years ago, and a very important person for us, for any of us who work in universities. I was listening to a talk by the Vice Chancellor of Melbourne University just last week, Glenn Davis, who explained that actually in coming up and devising the Melbourne model, that I'm sure you know about, this model where students come and they do a fairly general first degree before moving into whatever it is that they move into, law or medicine or this or that, to a general degree. And he was saying that what had played a very important role in influencing the governors, the people who were in charge of the University of Melbourne, was actually Newman's model of a university. He wrote a very famous book called The Idea of a University. I might tell you, people might be interested to ask a little bit more about that. At one stage in his life, John Henry Newman was asked by the Archbishop of Dublin. It was in about the 1840s, just after the Irish famine actually. He was asked to come to Dublin by the Archbishop of Dublin and establish a Catholic university for Ireland, the Catholic University of Dublin. Remember at that time, Catholics were not permitted to go to Oxford or Cambridge, for that was simply impossible. You had to sign up to the 39 Articles of Faith. There had been what were called Queen's Colleges established in Ireland at that time, but the bishops, and particularly Archbishop Cullen, wanted to establish a Catholic university in Ireland. And John Henry Newman, being very famous in his time throughout England, throughout the United Kingdom, they asked him to come and be the rector, the vice-chancellor, to establish this university. And so, in embarking on that project, he gave a series of lectures, and then he augmented that series of lectures with some essays which he wrote at a later stage. And when they were collated together, they form a book which we now call The Idea of a University, which most people, particularly in the senior ranks of universities, would know about. It's just a very famous book about university education. John Henry was recognised by many people in his life as being a particularly saintly person himself. I personally think anybody who gets to 89, you know, it's another thing to live a long life and to be regarded as a saint. He left a couple of very interesting instructions concerning his burial, John Henry Newman. He was a cardinal. He was made a cardinal about 10 years before his death, at the age of 89. And remember, a cardinal, what's a cardinal? A cardinal is basically a person who's going to be involved in the election of a new pope. That's what a cardinal is. And until recently, it was possible that a lay person could be a cardinal. Nowadays, the rules have been changed a little bit, and that's not possible under the current rulings. He made two instructions. He left two instructions. One of them was that he be buried in the same grave as his dearest friend, closest confidant, and in a sense most faithful of supporters in his work, a man called Ambrose St. John. This was one of his best friends. He died about 40 years before Newman himself died, and he asked to be buried in the very same grave. And he was. All sorts of questions around that now. And in fact, some members of the gay community have suddenly claimed John Henry Newman as the patron saint of gays and the great advocate of gays and so forth. Remember, the whole notion of homosexuality is actually quite new. They would never even use that word in Newman's time. And I'm sure that that's not true of him. I think it's a sad thing actually about our culture that we live in a world and in a culture that's so highly sexualized that we tend to see any close friendship as what's going on here. What's going on? I'm sure you know what I mean. That was his first request, and it was honored. The second request was that he asked that when he was buried, that he be buried in very rich compost. You might want to remember this when you're writing your last will and testament. And he did that quite deliberately. And they honored that as well. I'll tell you what happened later in a minute. Many people in John Henry's time did regard him as a saint. He was an extraordinary man. I'll tell you more about his story later if you want me to tell you about it. And he knew this. He also had very good friendships. I'll come back to that point later too. And I think that, by the way, when he died, he the ones that were destroyed. I think to sit down with my calculator and work out how many that is per day, Sean. I bet you don't write 20,000. You probably write 20,000 emails, you know. Most of them fairly innocuous and not worth saving. He wrote 20,000 letters and left about 40 books. I mean, he was a real academic, although he was actually a very pastoral person. And actually, that was critical in his idea of a university. And in fact, he lost a job, one of his early jobs. He lost because he fell out with the principal of Oriel College. He was made a fellow of Oriel College at age 21, if I remember correctly. It was like winning a research position at ANU at age 21. Anyone would have given their IT. It was the most prestigious, the most highly regarded of colleges at the Oxford University at the time. And part of his work there, he was also a tutor that helped him earn money. His father had meanwhile died, so he was supporting his mother and his sisters. But he actually fell out with the new principal, the new provost of the college, who was appointed a year or two after John Henry Newman took up his position at Oriel College. And actually they fell out over what it was that was the role of the tutor. The new provost believed that the relationship between a tutor and a student was purely academic. And Newman disagreed. He was obviously very strong-willed and very strong-minded. He believed that the role of a tutor in regard to the students was not just academic, but pastoral and spiritual. It was to do with their formation as a whole person. Well, the provost didn't agree with him, and like most provosts and vice chancellors, they rule. They win. So the provost stopped directing the students to John Henry Newman's care. It became financially unviable for John Henry Newman to stay there, and he left. But a very important notion in his idea of university is the formation of the whole person. Not just their academic development, but their spiritual and personal formation. Anyway, he had very good friendships, and it was clearly talk while John Henry Newman was alive, quite early in his life, in his 60s, his 70s, and his 80s, about him being a saint. That's why he asked to be buried in rich compost. And I should also say that John Henry Newman, earlier in his life, had actually visited Rome. It had been quite an important visit for him. And he'd been rather shocked and not happy with some of what he thought were excessive devotional practices that he saw, particularly in Italy, around relics and about devotions and piety and ritual. He wanted to be buried in rich compost, and he was. Anyway, just a few years ago, I'm not sure whether it was 2 or 3 years ago, there was the announcement that John Henry Newman would be declared blessed, which is it's the penultimate step on the way to being a saint. On his first declared venerable, Mary Ward, founder of the Reto Sisters, the Institute for the Blessed Virgin Mary, just last year declared venerable. The next step is to be declared blessed, and the last step is the step that Mary MacKillop will undergo this next weekend, when she's canonized. She's declared a saint for the whole church, for the universal church. Anyway, it was decided as a result of the Vatican's processes that John Henry Newman would be declared blessed, and that this event would take place in September 2010. And in preparation for that, the church in England started to prepare for that great ceremony and for the thousands of people who would arrive from all over the world, including members from universities all over the world, especially Catholic universities who hold his vision very dear. And so they thought it was appropriate to move his remains and to install them in the church so that he could more easily visit them. So a sarcophagus was built and was installed in the church already, and then at the site of the grave, a great procession, and there was incense and candles and singing, and the grave diggers arrived. They were going to disinter, to remove his remains from his grave. And they found absolutely nothing there. Nothing. Not a single bone, nothing. and John Henry Newman would have been absolutely delighted. It is true, he was buried in a fairly damp spot, which would have accelerated the process of decomposition, but I'm sure the rich compost helped as well. He was no fool. He was no fool, he knew what he was doing. But they are peculiar beings, as he said, remarkable in many ways, and larger than life in many ways, and I find them personally awe-inspiring. But then again, every community has its heroes and heroines, people who epitomise the values and the virtues that that community holds dear. And I think of some of the people who fall into that category for me. I think of Nelson Mandela, for whom I have enormous admiration, of Martin Luther King, of Weary Dunlop, our own Weary Dunlop, an amazing man, of Fred Hollis, the great eye surgeon. I think of the Anzacs. I think of Simpson and his donkey. That was an amazing story, you know, that man Simpson. For 24 days, he just walked fearlessly on the land of the Anzacs, picking up those who'd been injured, and then eventually he himself was shot. But was that not an example of heroic virtue? You know, this man who by any other reckoning was just Mr. Anybody, Mr. Everybody, doing heroic things. I think of Florence Nightingale and the extraordinary things that she did. So we do have heroines and heroes, people who somehow encapsulate all that we hold dear. And that is, at one level, what the saints are for us. They are our heroes and our heroines, people who demonstrate in their very lives what it is, some of the things that we hold dear. Actually, the Church's catalogue of saints, I only learnt this last week. It's always good to have talks like this because you have to do a bit of homework and find out a few things in advance. There are about 7,000 holy ones whom the Church has declared as saint or blessed. On those three steps, venerable, blessed, saint. There are firstly the martyrs, those who shed their life's blood for the faith. And I think, for example, when I went to this shrine in Japan just a few years ago, of Paul Niki and the Japanese martyrs in Nagasaki, who were with the expulsion, the extermination of Christianity from Japan in the 16th century, were asked to declare where they stood. And actually I've seen drawings in Japan of the process that was used. The officials, the government officials would arrive in the town and they would have an image, a face of the Lord Jesus. And every member of the community was asked to stand up as a sign of their lack of affiliation, their apostatizing. And this group of about 24 martyrs in Nagasaki refused to do that. There were children among them, there were seminarians, there were priests and brothers, and they were martyred, crucified. And there's a beautiful shrine to them in Nagasaki right now. You might be interested to know, and I've only learned this in the last few months myself, when it comes to the canonization of a martyr, they don't actually have to work any miracles. The Church does not require that in the process. The very gift of their life, their offering of their own life, is taken as the great miracle. I find that an interesting idea. And of course, the cult of the martyrs actually goes back to the martyrs, those very early Christians. And the New Testament tells us the story of Stephen, St. Stephen, the first of the Christian martyrs. I love that story. There's a little Trinitarian icon in it. Stephen's very much depicted both in terms of the Annunciation, but also in terms of the Trinity. He's stoned to death by Paul of Tarsus. Paul, the great, the highly educated Roman citizen and opponent of the Christians, himself to undergo a remarkable conversion experience. But he plays a part in the martyrdom of Stephen. And the early Christians have recognized the sanctity of these people who gave their lives to the faith. Those who went and were, for me, it was wonderful sport apparently, I find it hard to imagine that thousands of people would turn out to see what would happen to young women, young and old, men and women and children being killed by wild animals. I just find it hard to imagine how humans could do that. But the Christians saw in those people extraordinary heroes. I'm not sure. I sometimes wonder whether I would have the courage and the conviction to do that. I'd like to think that I would, and as a child I often thought about it. I'm still not sure just how I measure up in that situation. But that's where the cult of the saints actually has its origins, in the cult of the martyrs, these people who gave their lives for the faith. There are, in fact, many women saints, and some mothers amongst them. There's the lovely story of Felicity and Perpetua. She was a noble woman, and this was her maid. They were mothers. One of their fathers came and begged them. This was during the Roman persecutions, the persecutions under the authorities of the emperor, begged them not to do this. One of them was leaving her young son. But no, they went with extraordinary courage and fortitude to their death. And we remember them in the liturgy of the saints. There are children amongst them, people like Bernadette of Lourdes and Marie Goretti. I've been really interested in recent years to look at the stories of some children who've been extraordinary examples of the faith, and I realise actually what comes through when you look at the stories of children who've had remarkable faith experiences, the stories of the saints who've had, about whom are told remarkable stories in their childhood, how important First Communion is. How very, very important. And for those of you who are going to be teachers, those of you who are teachers, never underestimate that is such a precious moment in a child's life. And your role in that is inestimable. Admittedly, there are far more men than women in the catalogue of saints, and there are relatively few saints who are married. Not sure what to make of that. I'm sure there are a few interpretations. There are many who are great scholars and theologians. I personally am looking forward to meeting Thomas Aquinas and Augustine of Hippo and Bonaventure and Alphonsus Liguori, who founded the Redemptorists, who was an amazing moral theologian, an amazing articulator of the Church's moral teachings and how to balance what we believe in principle with the pastoral realities of a particular person's life. And of course, John Henry Newman, a great scholar, a great theologian. Some of them were artists and poets. John of the Cross, for example, is recognized within Spanish literature as one of the greatest poets of Spain. Not one of the greatest religious poets, he is that indeed, and we recognize him as that, but as a great poet. And there are apostles and missionaries. Remember, one of the patron saints of Australia is Francis Xavier, one of the earliest Jesuits, a friend of Ignatius Loyola, who undertook a great missionary exercise to Japan and to China, died actually of a fever as he was about to embark on a great missionary exercise to China. I love their stories. There were great preachers like Ambrose of Milan. It was he who influenced Augustine. Augustine didn't begin life as a Christian. In fact, was quite a critic of Christianity. But under the influence of the preaching of Ambrose of Milan, actually converted to Christianity. That's a Dominic, the founder of the Dominicans, a great preacher and teacher. Some wonderful and radical innovators. Benedict, who I mentioned before, my father's confirmation name. I personally have great affection for Teresa of Avila, a Spanish woman, an amazing woman. Reformed the Carmelite order, very sensible woman, of enduring meaning and good sense for us. And some of them were fearless reformers. Catherine of Siena had no hesitation. She was illiterate, actually. I think, if I remember correctly, she was one of 9 or maybe it was 11 children. She had no hesitation in calling popes to account for their failure to lead the church properly and rightly and in the ways of holiness. Probably one of the most loved of all the saints in Christianity is, of course, Francis of Assisi. I can't imagine anyone who doesn't love Francis for the simplicity of his lifestyle, the simplicity of the life to which he calls us. He's one of those saints who experienced what we call the stigmata. Not that any of the saints who are graced with that enormous blessing, they don't proclaim it, they usually hide it. But the marks of the crucifixion on his own body. And indeed, when Francis of Assisi died, and he was only in his 40s when he did die, they referred to him as a little Christ. Francis of Assisi, a little Christ. And indeed, it seems to me that's what every saint is, a little Christ. But not just the saints. That's what we are called to be little Christs. In our part of the world, doing whatever work we're called to do, but called first and foremost to be little Christs. Another, of course, of the great saints is Ignatius of Loyola, founder of the Jesuit order and a number of women's orders who find their inspiration in him. Actually, Ignatius was determined, it's not quite unusual with the Jesuits, they're one of the few religious orders that don't have a women's order. And Ignatius was quite determined about that. There was one particular woman who wanted to become a measure of the Jesuits, and I think caused Ignatius quite a bit of grief. She was really quite a nuisance to him. I'm sure that that's one of the reasons why he declared that there would never be a woman's order, in a way that there is, for example, in the Dominicans or the Franciscans, or many religious orders have a men's order and a women's order, not the Jesuits. And that goes right back to Ignatius himself, and I'm sure to this woman who caused him a lot of angst. For me, one among the most inspiring of the saints are the mystics. And I hope that when you go to Ireland, you'll go to Glendalough, where St. Kenan lived. And that's a beautiful place. A beautiful place. And he himself, I find, a remarkable figure. Actually, Seamus Heaney has written a lovely poem about Kevin. It's called Kevin and the Black Bird. I encourage you to read it if you're interested. One of the greatest mystics, Bernard of Clairvaux, again, a great reformer of religious life. And one of my great favourites is another woman called Julian of Norwich. We're not even sure what Julian's name was. She was an anchorite. Anchorites are people who attach themselves, actually, to churches. She lived in this little cell that was attached to the church of St. Julian of Norwich and took on the name of Julian. And she, so the cell was physically attached to the side of the church. It had three windows in it. One window, she could see the altar, so she could participate in Mass through that window. One other window was for her maids. She did actually have maids who would bring her food and after her. She had a cat as well. And the other window is for people who would come constantly to her and seek her advice, seek her counsel. It might be about health issues, it might be about spiritual issues, it could be about any and every issues. She was a wonderful woman. She lived in a time of the plague, when the plague was running rife through England. And in fact, there were three major assaults of the plague in Norwich during her lifetime. And at that very time, there were some clerics, some priests, who were teaching, this might ring a bell with you, they were teaching that the plague was a punishment to the people for their sinfulness. It reminds me of some people now who preach that, for example, AIDS is a punishment for the sinfulness of our generation. And here's Julian living at this desperate time in many ways. The population was decimated as those plagues went through the population and caused the death of a significant number of the population. exactly the opposite of that. And it's a message for all time, I think. She's the one who says, all will be well. And all shall be well. And she has the most beautiful homely images of God. God being homely and courteous and kindly. Well worth your reading. She writes in Middle English, there's some lovely renditions of her work in modern English. I have very special affection for her. Of course, some of the saints enjoyed considerable prestige and fame in their lifetimes. People like Elizabeth of Hungary, but others lived out their lives in relative obscurity and ordinariness. In Thérèse of Lisieux's community, she was a young nun, she joined the Carmelite order in Lisieux. Some of her very own sisters in her very own community disregarded her as just a very ordinary person, nothing special about Thérèse. And yet, she was recognized by some, and it's amazing after Therese's death how quickly her story spread throughout Europe, and how quickly she became a very popular saint in the church. Even my father, who was born in 1916, his generation knew a lot about Therese. She died in the early 1900s. I can't remember exactly what year it was, 1902 or about 1900. They knew her story. And she was much loved, and is still much loved. There was a younger sister who joined the Carmelite order in Dijon, a few miles away from Lisieux. These two didn't ever actually meet. Her name was Elizabeth of the Trinity. She joined the Carmelites in about 1880. She died aged 26. Amazing how many of the saints died young. She died of a disease that these days would have been easily treated, but no treatment was known at that time. She too lived out her life in what, by any kind of merely human reckoning, was a very ordinary life, enclosed in a cloister. But another woman of extraordinary virtue, extraordinary heroism, and extraordinary meaning for us. Now, some of the saints, and Mary MacKillop is one of them, but not by no means the only one, faced enormous resistance from church authorities. Some were even excommunicated. Mary MacKillop, as you know, was actually excommunicated during the course of her lifetime. But this is very serious. When you're excommunicated, that means you can no longer belong to the religious order to which you've committed to. Mary MacKillop's followers were told to go home, as were Mary Ward's. Mary Ward was also excommunicated. The good thing in Mary MacKillop's life is that the bishop later realised that he had made a mistake and repented of that mistake and withdrew the excommunication. And the order was re-established. That was not the case for Mary Ward. When Mary Ward died in 1645, everything to which she committed herself to was in tatters, absolute tatters. She'd been excommunicated, which means she couldn't be buried in the church grounds. Now, this is serious. There's a sister in the United States right now who is being declared excommunicated by her bishop. And I can't help but wonder what she's going through at the moment. And this great debate as to whether that in fact has been fairly done in terms of what's actually happened in that case. But it is extremely serious. Extremely serious. And of course there are the legions who've laboured in heroic service to the sick and the needy or in education. People like Catherine McCauley, like Mary Ward, or like Mary MacKillop, all of these people who've done extraordinary things in terms of service to the marginalised, service to the poor, service to the needy, all of the little Christs. Amongst my favourites, I confess at the moment, are those who've, amongst those who've given themselves in really radical self-sacrifice, includes Damien of Molokai. Have you heard of him? Declared a saint relatively recently. And in fact, when I was in Belgium just a few weeks ago, I didn't actually know that his remains were returned, or most of them were returned to Leuven, which is where he'd come from. just recently, and the person who was with me from Leuven took me to the chapel where his remains were, a very simple tomb there, and that's where he was. And on his tomb was engraved his utterly beautiful expression. I wish I'd written it down at the moment, I looked on the web to find it. But it was something along these lines. He's Damien, a young priest, offers to go to work amongst the lepers in Hawaii. And of course, what happens to him? He eventually contracts leprosy himself and dies there. What a heroic story. But on his tomb are written these words that he wrote. My greatest pleasure is to serve the Lord in his poor children that have been rejected by other people. I find that really touching. And it makes me wonder in my life, who am I serving? And his delight, his greatest pleasure to serve precisely those people whom everyone else rejected. And I think too of Maximilian Kolbe, whom some of you would know. Anybody know him? Yeah. He's the man who in Auschwitz, some event had taken place and the authorities, I forget what the event was, I think one of the guards had been killed. So the authorities proclaimed that 10 of the inmates, 10 of the captives, could be executed by way of reprisal. So they picked 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And one of them is a man, a young father with children, and he says, but what am I going to do? What's going to happen to my family? And Maximilian steps forward and says, I'll go in your place. And so he does, and so he dies. I'd like to think that I have the courage to do that. I just have a horrible feeling I wouldn't. And he doesn't take time to think about that. He just does it spontaneously. And so that act of radical self-sacrifice. And of course there's our own saint, Mary MacKillop. Our own homegrown Australian saint, born of Scottish parents. And what's her life about? Unswerving service to the education of the poor, the marginalised, Indigenous people, and the model of life that she lived for her sisters. How much she suffered, and she's about to be canonised next week. And I find it interesting to think about Mary MacKillop and why it is that the press have taken such interest in this. I mean, this is of concern to us and people like us who place great meaning in this and for whom she's very important. I find it interesting to think about why the secular press is so interested in it. They weren't that interested, for example, in John Henry Newman in England. And I think it's because, this is the conclusion I've arrived at, I think it's because Mary MacKillop in many ways encapsulates not only the values that we hold dear as a Christian community, basically love of neighbour, love of God, heroic virtue, heroic service. She was goodness itself. The union with the lives of the saints. The people around them often talk about how kindly they were, how kind, how courteous. Even to people who are hurting them and seeking to undermine them and defaming them. And that happened with Mary MacKillop, for sure. There's heroic models. But why is the secular press so interested? I think it's because Mary MacKillop also encapsulates many of the values and virtues that we hold dear as an Australian community. In many ways, she's a little Aussie battler, don't you agree? Like, here she is. Like, she encapsulates a lot of the things we hold dear. There's a certain anti-authoritarianism about her. And she suffers at the hands of the authorities. And she continues on indefatigably. And she just keeps going. When she dies, the congregation facing serious debt problems. She herself suffered ill health during her lifetime. But I think that's what's going on there. And in a way, I'm pleased that she's our first Australian saint. because she so captivates the wider Australian population, not just captivating us who believe in all of this. Our communities are real people, our models in the faith, people for us to emulate and to model and to find, in whom to find inspiration and encouragement. And of course, preeminent amongst this whole communion of saints is Mary herself, Mary the mother of Jesus. We don't actually know much about her, but the little that we know about her is quite incredible. She was a young girl, maybe 14 or 15, and this heroic act of faith that characterizes her whole life is awe-inspiring. When I think of the saints, I think of what do they have in common, what's different about them. In a sense, all of them are our teachers, each and every one of them in their own way, I think. And they teach us with their very lives. Some of them do writing and teach us through their writings, but most of them teach us with their very lives. They're people who put their money and their very lives where their mouths are. And actually, they're not usually telling us what to do. They just get on and do it. And I think what they demonstrate to us is the power of God and the power of grace in a human life, in a life that's prepared somehow in some way which I find awe-inspiring, a life that's prepared to yield in faith, hope and love to that call that they sense in God, that call on their life, do this. Mary MacKillop, for example, felt called to education. She just felt this sure calling that was never lost in her. And I think in another way, we see in them writ large the very beatitudes of which Jesus spoke when he gave that Sermon on the Mount. They're poor in spirit, they're meek, they're merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, hungering and thirsting after justice. All of them doing that, each in their own way, teaching us with their very lives. And their stories are as varied as the stars in the sky. And in fact, I think of them as being like stars in the sky. So many of them. And each of them, what I think they do have in common, and when you read the lives of the saints, is the extraordinary intimacy that they have with God. And they live their whole lives in prayer. Not just prayer at this time of the day or the other, they're all great prayers. Their whole life is a prayer. And I've got some words here from Teresa of Avila, really sensible woman. By no means given to radical excesses. I mean, some of the saints are given to extraordinary excesses. But she's so sensible. And she talks about the experience of prayer, and this is what she says. These are her words. It's like the experience of two persons here on earth who love each other deeply and understand each other well. Even without signs, just by a glance it seems, they understand each other. And I think of another story of Elizabeth of the Trinity. One of the sisters said to her one day, because Elizabeth used to spend quite a bit of time, she was just transported in prayer, just sitting there in prayer, such that even the sisters who lived in the same house with her were somewhat surprised by this and in awe of this. And they said to Elizabeth, well, how can you do it? How can you pray like that? And Elizabeth's answer was, but we love each other. And I often think about that. We love each other. When we love somebody, we don't need to feel every moment of the time talking with each other. We just spend a lot of time being quiet with each other. And in that mystery of love with another person, there's somehow always that newness. We're always learning more about each other, entering more deeply into the mystery of each other, and ever surprised by each other. Love doesn't get tired, and it doesn't get exhausted, and it doesn't need to talk all the time. And here's Elizabeth of the Trinity simply saying, well, we love each other. Why wouldn't I want to sit with the one who is my lover? I think I want to stop there for a little while.
That was Professor Anne Hunt on Holiness and Sainthood. Guinness and God is presented once a month at King Amalie's Pub in Canberra. And for more, visit cradio.org.au.